Good afternoon, everybody. We'd like to call the meeting to order, please. Debbie, if you could do the roll call.
Debbie Berry.
Here.
Dan Moore.
Here.
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do we have a motion to approve our minutes from the previous meeting on November 17th?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We can move right into the new business.
I was going to say good morning because I'm used to it.
Stop it.
Change is good. Here we are at 1 o'clock. We have our first general action item. We have the swearing in of three of our new Rangers. And if I can have the chief and his team come forward to have the swearing in occur. So Stephen A. Davis, Luis Santiago, and Renee, please come forward.
Good morning, commissioners. Good morning, everybody. Yes, can I have Drew, Stephen, and Luis can join me up here. We'll get there in a minute. So everybody can see the bios of our three finest, newest young Rangers. This isn't just another swearing in for us, you know, and the leadership team of Cleveland Metro Parks, many of you, myself, Captain Flanagan, embarked on a pretty significant project back in 2013. We had a wish list of exactly the resources and the specialized units and the tools and everything, including workspace we need to make sure that went well. This is the last piece. We've been looking for the right team, the exact number for about that long. And so this is the last class, the six that we swore in recently, plus these three, this is the last group.
Can you say that again, Dan?
Yeah. Last time I'll bring it up. It's true. We set our sights on something. Brian and I have a leadership team, and we're here. And so you are absolutely the last piece of a very significant puzzle for us. So congratulations, welcome aboard. I want to take a minute or two, not too long, to have you introduce who you brought along with you, and you cannot miss an opportunity to highlight that for us. So let me start with you.
All right, I'm Stephen Davis. I go by Drew. I brought my dad, Steve Davis, who works at the Vermilion Police Department. I'm excited. I'm a Buckeye fan, a Brown fan, so it's going to be a win against
Clemson. Yeah, that's right. We'll introduce him later. That's all we've got.
Probably the biggest influence that I have in my life, so he's very excited to be here today. Thank you for sharing
your
family with us. We appreciate it. Please.
I think I brought the whole family.
Take a minute or two.
Please,
please introduce
yourself. To the family is my nephew, Joey.
How old is your nephew?
2 weeks. He just turned 2 weeks old, right? I'm stressed. My brother, Giovanni Santiago, is a Cleveland police officer. He's in the Air Force. My sister-in-law, Lily, she's also in the Air Force. My beautiful wife, Tania. And best friend and co-worker from Wake Bend, what's your name? John Montgomery. His uncle, Paul Montgomery, a good friend to the family.
I better take the mic back on that. So two of the three families are law enforcement families already, so thank you, you know, for sharing your families with us, obviously, introducing them to the career. So why don't the three of you step forward, introduce you to Commissioner Berry. She will help administer the oath of office.
So go stand in front of the table. Yeah, I want to be a good picture, so.
Thank you, Commissioner.
This is always one of my favorite parts. If you would please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, insert your name.
I, Stephen Davis,
do solemnly swear, that I will support the Constitution, and the laws of the United States of America, the Constitution, and the laws of the State of Ohio, and the rules and regulations, of the Cleveland Metro Parks, And I will discharge the duties. Of the office of ranger. To which I have been appointed. To the best of my ability. I will faithfully carry out. And implement the policies enunciated. And the instructions given to me.
And the instructions given to me.
By the Board of Park Commissioners.
By the Board of Park Commissioners.
Of the Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
Of the Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
This I promise to do.
This I promise to do.
As I shall answer unto God.
As I shall answer unto God.
Congratulations.
So families of our guests, if you want to move toward the door here, I think that the captains will take our three members out and families will welcome to join. I think it's important that you hear their message and then we can continue business in this room on another matter. So thank you for coming.
Congratulations.
And that we
hope.
This is the authorization that we're asking for to acquire this in a fee simple, again contingent on the BioEPA's the control of this water resource restoration fund.
Move the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next one is just a consumption. This is part of TEC, and so we had an originally consumption of $49,500. This pushed up through the second phase of really the scoping of construction through our HVAC system for the main portion of the original building. Essentially sat in a lean-to shed, and it was decided that the shed should come down based on condition. It opened up a couple of windows, and it also put the HVAC system in a much better position along the way. As the board, some may remember, the conversation started back in 2008, 2009. The original cost of the building was right in about the 8.5, 8.6 under construction. You can see that they had a $500,000 to $750,000 for a new structure. We had chosen to renovate it in a number of different phases to include the one that we're currently sitting in. It's been here almost 2 years. And then we hope to
in the next 30 days, we have full access to the additional wing. So we should be all in around that $4 billion, and we've really provided high quality space to all of our staff along the way. So to be commended for
so we're
all
well under half of what it originally had contemplated.
Correct. We have some parking lot modifications that, and since require opportunities that we're trying to present for other granting sources along the way and traffic flow. And so that's probably one thing that we'll be looking at moving forward in the future. But we hope to have the new section open here in 30 days. And then we have some renovations and some things that we have to add to along the way. So that recommended action falls on the top portion of page 4.
Move the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is the agreement that we have reached with the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District. This has been a, what I would say, a good public work. We have spent many hours working with and negotiating through how we are providing stormwater management through Cleveland Metro Parks. We have helped provide an amicus brief on behalf of the court for the NEORSD's case. We have come to a resolution on how Cleveland Metro Parks will be treated, how we will be essentially monetizing the opportunity to do stormwater projects within Cleveland Metro Parks. And so this agreement essentially codifies how we will be paying our stormwater management fee, how we will be allowing for those funds to go into the reimbursement category, and the pathway by which we will be doing projects that will impact stormwater and how we handle it in Cleveland Metro Park. So it is with great pride that we were able to bring this one forward after a long amount of work. Recommend action if there's questions.
One question. Can you just sort of scope out very, this is complicated, but just very broadly what this does?
Well,
the importance of this thing to this deal to us.
It really, and to kind of couch it and frame it, the way our agency was being essentially classified, we were a non-member participant. And so our fee, essentially, that we would have paid would have gone to potentially other areas in their service district. What this agreement provides for is the opportunity for our fee to go into stormwater management for projects on Cleveland Metro Parks property and or adjacent if they have a high impact to maintain stream and erosion corridors along the way. So it was really a great opportunity for both sides, whereas the sewer district brings the like complement amount of money to do projects.
Very good.
I just want to note, though, that this really came from Brian, your leadership, and going and talking to the sewer district and finding a way for our dollars, which we had to invest, to go back into our projects and, again, really leveraging our money. So congratulations and thank you for that.
Well, I'd second that. I think we all should be mindful of the fact that the litigation itself really, in very simple terms, hinged upon how other political subdivisions were addressing this issue and how the regional sewer district really has an umbrella over all of us. So it's a district-wide form of levying. It's generating dollars so that the district then can decide where best to send those dollars. So it's a common source from all these different political subdivisions. And everyone's always looking at, well, how do I get a slice of the pie? I think for the regional sewer district, the challenge has been coming up with criteria on how those dollars will be managed best. For us to be able to really sit at the table and say, we're also a regional entity. We cover a whole lot of areas. And we probably can show that we're complementary in terms of what we take care of actually does benefit the larger group. And I think that's a sensitive balance that regional sewer needed to work out with this. So yeah, this is a big deal.
And again, the work of Minnie Rose and Jim Rotstrom and Joe and Terry Robeson and Sean, I mean, the breadth of people that got involved to make sure that we managed this and measured it and quantified it and put it into context, I'm really proud that these projects will be happening, you know, within our boundaries and within our control to help influence stormwater. It's not going away. You hear of all the different things, you know, whether you believe in climate change or not, but certainly I think we've had 300-year floods that have come through the zoo, and they're working with us on being impactful on Big Creek and some of the influence of that. We partnered with that. We've really figured out how to partner some of these public partnerships, and they've become very much a mainstay in how we operate.
Good. Move in motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Next action item for consideration in front of the board is the authorization of the 2017 compensation range of the performance wage adjustments, for the non-union staff. We are looking, again, pursuant to Article 4 with bylaws, we're looking for the recommended action to move the cost of living adjustment in the market up 1%, and that essentially then would be establishing the range of approximately 84.86 to 237.350, and then the authorization also includes the aggregate total of the wages, performance-based wages would be in the 3%. Category. We also have, again, continued our forced distribution in the range of 1 to 4%. We've been very, very successful in working through our employees and bringing them forward. Aaron's got a couple of quick slides, and hopefully I didn't steal everything that he was going to say.
You did not. Good afternoon. So I wanted to give a brief overview of that 3% Ryan spoke about and how it's allocated within the non-bargaining staff. So, one of the things we always like to articulate is how we use the performance management system at Cleveland Metro Park. So a couple of things, we look at it to plan for the next year, we look at it to link development to succession planning, and it is the tool, lastly, to determine compensation with the 3% budget that's being recommended today. So since 2013, we have utilized the forced distribution method. So what that does is it looks at the contributions of staff, and then it compares staff against other staff, I guess. Or we look at who has done more in that year, and that's how we determine how compensation is administered in that year. So the important part, and I'm not going to read all the bullet points, but the important part is the calibration process. So HR, once the evaluations are completed, we sit down with every chief in the organization and go through the evaluations from top to bottom to make sure they're consistent across the entire organization. So for about 3 weeks, we spend, you know, a significant amount of time with the chiefs going through their evaluations to make sure that we're consistent with the performance of the individual. It's a difficult process because you have to make some hard decisions, but I think since 2013 it has worked well for us. If you pay attention to all the success that Cleveland Metro Parks has had, it's all because of the employees that we have in the organization. They make it happen. So we think it has worked well in terms of adding to the communication. It's been very candid and open, and we've also put some plans in place for those that are doing well in the organization. So how's it broken down in 2016? Well, it's broken down by percentages. Exceptional, you find that's the 10%, that's the high-end performers, and that changes yearly based on their performance. So it's not the same people every year, it's based on their work plans and how they delivered and executed in that year. You have 20% in the outstanding, which is the second category. Commendable is that solid employee, and then you have 10% that are in the below average, which are placed on the performance improvement plan. And part of their raise is held until they complete that performance improvement plan. So all of this is done within the 3% that is being recommended to the board today. So it looks like a bell curve when you look at it. So it's 10, and then the biggest group is in the 60%, and then it goes 20, 10. So another term for forced distribution is the bell curve evaluation process. So that's why it looks like a bell curve. So where are we today? The calibration process is in process right now. It will be completed in December. We've completed all but one meeting, and then we get the information to Brian so we can have a discussion and show him how the ratings are being administered. The individual performance reviews will take place end of this month, 1st of January. And the increases will be granted sometime in January, and we also complete the performance improvement plans in January as well. New for 2017, I think this was discussed last year, and we're going to execute this in 2017. Although union employees are not under a pay-for-performance system, we think there's some value in completing the calibration process for union employees. especially since we're going into negotiations in 2017. So we think that's going to be beneficial, and we're also implementing a new evaluation tool in 2017, which is scalable, and you can cater it to the person, you can create competencies for departments, so it's really neat that we have this evaluation tool that will relate to each department based on what the chiefs want to set up as a criteria related to performance. So,
what is that evaluation? That's a piece of software.
It's through ADP. So we have ADP and HR. We purchased, I think it was in late 2015. We purchased this as a module, an add-on to what we already have. So that's a brief overview. Recommended action, I think it's page 31.
I have a question on that performance improvement plan. So you introduced it to the employee in January, as you know, you're talking about where they ended up. How long do you give them to kind of get through that plan? Or how long
it's about 6 months. Okay. We set about June as the target date. Some go a little longer depending on the circumstances, but June is usually the target date.
And then you sit back down and evaluate whether they met the goals.
And there's some meetings in between there to make sure they're staying on task, but yes, June is usually that drop dead date.
I particularly like the idea of providing the union employees feedback on how they're doing. I think irrespective of whether or not it has anything to do with salary, I think it's very important particularly important for them to be able to understand how they fit and the future and all that sort of stuff. I think that's terrific you've introduced that.
Yeah, they're evaluated now, but we think the calibration process will tighten that process up and provide better feedback.
So when you say calibration, describe that a little more.
Similar to how we do it with the non-bargaining staff, is the managers complete the evaluations, and there's a number or a rating attached to it. And with every rating, you have to give some sort of narrative as to why you gave that rating, to justify the rating. And then we sit down and make sure that it's consistent, they're not elevating scores, some people are scoring very hard, so we make sure we calibrate it across the organization.
Yeah, so you get a bell curve in the same
Correct.
Way you did, yeah. Very good. Well, if there's no other comments, I move the motion.
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Harold, and the team, and all of the managers that are putting the effort into making this process work. The next one is change order number 7 and final. This is for the Mill Creek Connector Trail Phase 2. Our team has worked since May 29th of 2014 when we awarded the contract to Independence Excavating in the amount of $3.293 million. We have gone through a number of different iterations and negotiations as it related to a claim for an undocumented utility along the way. We have resolved that. The claim, the adjustment that is related to this is in change order 7, it is for $125,000, and the recommended action falls on the bottom portion of page 6.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
The next action item we have is the Professional Services Agreement Amendment Number 3, Coastal Shoreline Professional Design Services, Euclid Beach Pier. These are working forward towards the construction documents. Sean has a couple of brief slides as we're working forward. Sean?
So before you today is an amendment to a contract to create the construction documents for Euclid Beach Pier. But before we got to the point where we are today, kind of want to show you real quick where we've been. Where we've developed the master plan for the lakefront portion of Eagle Creek Reservation, and we are literally ticking away at a lot of these major capital improvements that are shown on the master plan, be that the bridge connecting Villa Angela and Wildwood, the beach improvements here at Villa Angela, the management center constructed in Wildwood, and now we're moving to the pier. So, just to give you a real quick recap, here's that bridge that is set. We've got nothing but positive feedback from folks who enjoy this either on foot or on bike. Gives a really quick and short connection, an ADA compliant connection to the beach and also the western portions of the park.
How long is that span? What did the span itself cost?
The span is about 165 foot span, And the bridge structure itself, just the structure.
Just the steel.
Just the steel is about $250,000 before it's set. So that's raw.
That's 160 feet.
Correct.
For what again?
About $250,000. That's just the steel. And then at Wildwood, we then completed our new management setup this summer. And you can see here that, staff is utilizing it to its fullest potential. And this is really giving the ability of the operations staff to manage our Cleveland Park to the highest, most efficiency possible. So again, I think they're very positive reviews internally on this project. And then we have the beach, where this summer we were able to bring a pretty large lifeguarded swimming area to life. And we are monitoring this as we go through the seasons and as we go through this winter. We've already done some summer work here in early November, and then when the weather calms down in April, we'll go back out and take another swimmer.
Just curious, any appreciable changes with the bottom or?
So far, only positives. So what we've seen is that we've had a lot of good sand movement in this area, but just off the picture, we've got a little divot that we're kind of tracking. So when we go back and do the sonar again in the spring, if the divot hasn't corrected itself, because these sands do shift, we'll do some additional work to address it.
What about between the two on the right-hand side?
Between the remainder of the...
Yeah, show me where the sills are and where they stop.
So we actually have sills between 4 and 5 and 5 and 6. So the sills are actually constructed off the picture here.
Okay.
So it's between
the 4 and 5. Sills and so, and those are the right.
Correct. These here, just with the way that the angle is on the photo, do not have sills constructed between them.
But there's still a safe beach area there. They're comfortable.
So there's a safe beach area if you take, if you take a line from the middle of this offshore breakwater to the east, basically to the creek.
So it's creeping along to the east, but you said there's a pocket somewhere in there as well. So you can't quite figure out what's causing that.
Well, we've got some sand shifting that's occurred because of the waves. We're expecting it to kind of self-level, but we'll know more in April.
Okay, it's too soon.
But you're planning on doing the other sills.
Well, we all hope that in the next years and decades to come, that yes, we can connect.
That this is an effective mechanism.
Exactly. So we're kind of testing proof of concept now.
You're measuring it. Yeah.
We'll know more.
And you're measuring it between two specific. So you have two measurement points where you're measuring.
Oh,
we actually have nearly infinite measurement points.
To the right of what we're seeing.
Two tests.
Correct. You've got two test scales. One between offshore breakwater.
But you're also seeing maybe this captures. It's almost like an inlet setup where it starts moving westward with the accretion, or.
Correct. Somewhat similar. The beach dynamics are completely different than Edgewater, but like Edgewater, there is a hook. There's a pocket.
Yeah.
So now we've somewhat kind of created that, especially with the break wall for Euclid Creek, where it outlets.
Catchers.
Just a question now. If you filled in the other gaps going west, what would roughly the cost of that be based on the first two gaps?
So in today's dollars, it's probably about $350,000 per sill.
Oh, per sill.
Per sill. Yes. And we learned a lot. We learned a lot in doing the first two.
It was the night before Christmas.
Moving on from Villa Angela, we also just recently demolished the pier, and we had pretty good success with Neroni and their speed in which they were able to demolish the pier. And then we're creative and sustainable in terms of the materials that were harvested from the pier. We will utilize them then in the next round of construction. So you can see that we segregated and stockpiled materials out on the beach.
Like riprap or for drainage?
For riprap and actual rubble mound and embankment underneath the new pier, which I'll show you here in just a second. So we've got the area now fenced off. We've got a sign up for the public education component, so visitors to the park understand what is coming and when it is coming. And with that now, we're working on that final design, trying to push out over the water as much as possible. Right now, we're about 120 feet over water, about 165 feet over land. Here's a rendition of the pier looking towards downtown. And so today, what's in front of you is that contract to create those construction documents for the pier here itself. But you know, we're not stopping here. We're also looking at what improvements we can be bringing to the plaza. So we'll be bringing you a GMP in the coming months, both for the pier and the plaza. And then from there, we're also looking to add different amenities in the park and around the pier so that this experience that the users and the guests have on the pier is one that's unique, where we could incorporate one of the Cleveland script signs. We've had a request to incorporate that idea, and we're looking at different ways to exactly accomplish that. And then Wendy has been working on some great new interpretives in the park. I'd love to hear you about that.
Sure. Well, one of the amenities we, of course, want to do is tell the story of Yucca Beach. So we do that with interpretive signs. So, and it's not just Yucca Beach. I just want to be clear that we're doing Wildwood and Villa Angela as well. We are not ignoring the rest of that lakefront. We've identified a lot of great stories to tell. And, of course, the amusement park is one that we definitely want to tell. So this amusement park was over in the end of the 60s, so many of us don't know those stories. We didn't get a chance to experience the amusement park at its time, so we want to tell those stories with interpretives that VizCom, Visual Communications, has been doing. And we're super excited about, it's kind of hard to tell with a slide, but these are the framework, these outlines are the framework of the signs themselves. So they are forged metal, and those will be the top of the interpretive signs. So the signs are interpretive, you can read them, but you can also just walk by them and see some of these iconic, obviously the arch is an iconic symbol of Yucca Beach. So that'll help tell our story in that particular site. So we're super excited about that. We're working with local partners, local stakeholders, the amusement Beach Boys, the guys who really are the storytellers for this, and it's been really fun to put those stories together, so we're excited about that.
Would that any questions on the pier or KS's?
One comment. If it's 350 between filling in between the gaps,
yes.
I'm just questioning what the public would like the most. In other words, where's the marginal utility value here? And I kind of think the beach is really important. And is there, relative to the pier, I mean, it's nice to have a big beach. Pier and putting up a Cleveland sign, we know we're in Cleveland. We're not that stupid. I mean, so I'm not sure.
I don't think that costs $350.
I'm not sure that, I mean, junking up the park, you got to be careful about that because, this is a beautiful area for children to swim, and we've given them a small area to swim, but we really ought to think big, I think, and think about what the utility is to the neighborhood and to the city. I mean, how do you guys come out?
I think that looked like a relatively decent-sized swimming area, though. I mean, folks were in the water, and I hope safely, so I mean, the lifeguard was down the water, so it was pretty...
I don't have an immediate answer, then I think we're probably growing the park in that area, so it's kind of recapturing... We're capturing something that really hasn't been there for a long time. So I think as time goes on, we'll be able to measure that. Typically, that seems to be what we do. So
I love it.
I think the answer to your question is probably going to be coming more self-evident over the next couple of years. I mean, we've heard so much historically about the pier and getting that back again. It's rather iconic. So I think that's what I mean, sort of investing in sort of recapturing that without being just nostalgic, but really iconic and making it a place that people will come to. They'll be able to picnic there. All kinds of people can use it, not just those that are going to swim. You've got the beach that's cleared, and I think what we'll see is the demand will start changing how that may
but evolve. Completing out the pier, what was the dollar number on that again? Running it out to say another 100 feet or so, or 50 feet.
Another 100 feet from where we're showing it ending today
would
be about $1,000 to $1,200 a foot. Yeah. All that.
I agree. To your point, that may be when that day comes, a few years out, we're going to have a better sense of empirical basis for is it left hand, is it right hand, is it some of both? How do we do that? I mean, I think it's a legitimate question.
Yeah, I think we. To me, I think. That every sculptor in the city of Cleveland wants to have their piece in the middle of some beautiful natural place. And we have to resist that. I love the interpretive idea, Wendy. I think that's terrific. I mean, I it's amazing to me that there are people in this room who don't remember Utah Beach and the Thriller and all the precious times going on there.
But I think we have to listen to the community. And so, again, just weigh the different options and see what folks want that are using the park itself. And we've had a master plan, we've had a number of community meetings and input, and so, you know, we should listen and again, figure out what works best for that park.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing, all of this is stuff that's been pretty well vetted. It's the next phase that's going to be.
Yeah, but for example, the Cleveland side, I mean.
It's been a request of the city council member and a number of the neighborhood advocates that there's no east side location, and so we were asked and positioned a little bit by the Destination Cleveland organization to see if it was a possibility would be used to back downtown. There was no commitment, there is merely a concept. And then the other thing is that we've seen visitation grow year over year almost by 17%. And so part of what we're doing, and Bruce I think articulated better than I probably will, we're measured in the approach. We provide the swim area, we've been listening to the public, we've been adding the amenities, and part of it is that, you know, let's see where it goes. I mean, we have to make sure that the proof of concept of the SILs and how they're applied and what we're actually doing that don't end up causing actually an adverse effect.
That's right.
I mean, so I think there's always this very unique balance. And I will tell you, out of all the things, I think the pier and the fountain, besides the swim area, were some of the most the highly rated components of what people, absent of putting the amusement park back, those were the components that people really wanted to see. And I can tell you, from an access point, ADA accessibility, all the things we're trying to do, that is really part of what we are as an agency. And so we partnered with Representative Bill Patman. There's been some money that's coming in from ODNR, coupled with funds from Metro Parks to really make this project happen. And again, I think, you know, to say it very as eloquently as possible, we're managing 23,000 acres in capital projects all over Cuyahoga County and Hinckley Township. I'm going to take each one of those seriously with the vetting process of where and how and what we're putting in the allocations, and we're always trying to make sure that we balance to the best of our ability. So this is one of those things where we kind of have to continue building it and see how the park adapts over time. And I think there's other land acquisitions that we would like to see potentially positioned, and that might be you know, one of the other things that we're looking at. So
yeah, there are a variety of things.
Stay tuned.
We're staying tuned. Yeah, we're running
out. And one does well with listening to us.
Recommended action falls on the top of page 8. If we're in concurrence with the recommended action for the professional services agreement of KS.
So moved.
I just figured I'd carry that through. The next item we have is the approval of there are no bids, and we're in vouchers and payroll.
Thank you. Asking for approval for resolution number 16-12-192. All of the vouchers included in have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code.
Move
approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
It is time to move into the information briefing and policy items. With us this morning is with great pleasure and after a long search that we have Natalie Ronan as our guest, and if Natalie can stand. I don't often get to do these, but this is, again, great pleasure. Natalie joined us almost 2 weeks ago. She came from the Holden Forest and Gardens most recently. She had spent time as the executive director of the Cleveland Botanical Gardens prior to their merger and rebranding. She has been a park advocate, I think, since day one, cultivating relationships both public and private. She also holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in biology, and she's providing diversity in our Big Ten University College by adding Indiana University to the list. And so she is very much hit the ground running. I have to add it where I can. So, but anyway, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Natalie Ronan to Cleveland Metro Park. So, anything you'd like to say, Natalie?
Thank you, Ryan, and good afternoon, commissioners. It's just my pleasure. I'm ecstatic to be here. I can't add much to what Ryan said other than I thought I knew and loved the Metro Parks before I started working here, and just in my third week, I am just blown away by the passion and the dedication, the breadth, and Brian making Ryan proud.
It's been so long.
I'd be struck a nerve.
I'm so choked up. I will let Karen do the next one.
Thank you. I am very excited to bring this before the board. This is a normal occurrence in the auditing world, but it is the first for Cleveland Metro Parks. Every year, the auditor of state is required to do audits of all the public entities. Every year, they look at their schedule and their staffing and say, we can't possibly do them all. Some of these we're going to have to contract out with an IPA, which in my role is an independent accounting firm, to go with that. So the auditors approached us this year, asked if we would be willing to allow a private firm come in. We said yes, whatever worked for their schedule. They sent out proposals to a list of firms. They then grade those proposals. After they grade them, they send it to us where we can add some points also to some of those scores. And when all of that came through, the firm that won the award is Clark Schaefer Hackett. So we're very excited to have that firm that will be on board starting in January to start the audit for us. It is a 5-year contract.
Yeah, can you explain why five?
That is how all of the auditor of state, when they let out for bid for to the private firms, all of theirs are for 5 years.
So that's their benchmark.
That is their benchmark. Definitely the auditor of state's office is the controlling factor in all of this. They're the ones that do the final selection. We do put in a few points, but they can go with the best score of all the firms, or they can go off sheet and pick somebody else for another reason. In this case, they did go with the one with the highest score. We did, Clark Schaefer has a lot of experience across the state. Their experience in our area may not have been as extensive. We did contact the city of Cleveland, where they've done the audit there, and the audit team at the city employees could not say enough good things about them.
Again, this is coming as an information item. It is not under the control. It is under the control of the auditor of state, so it was merely briefing the commissioners that the audit positioning function will actually change coming into the next few years.
Do we know how they decide who they don't have time for or how they want to look? Is it just
we have never, they do rotate because we're being let out now for this 5-year period. There will be a chance for us to extend that one more time, then they would bring us back out. They like to make sure that there's a rotation so that they're touching every
right,
entity.
Yeah. And this is an incremental cost for us, right?
That's the fee over the 5 years.
Correct.
So it's basically about 30,000-ish per year. So it's fairly consistent with where we've been before. That is not even per year.
Yeah, okay.
Cost.
I thought it was per year.
Oh, no. That is the total for all 5 years.
Yes, okay. I see. That's a bargain.
That's such a view.
It is.
Very good. Thank you, Karen, and the hard work and rolling back up to the auditor of state. If there are no further questions on the audit process, we are very pleased to bring a kind of a new concept that Wendy and team have been championing and vetting, and we're still, this is a work in progress, but this is the concept of building off of, again, one of the core pillars of Metro Parks education, and it's really the concept of bringing through our outdoor education department a nature-based preschool concept. I don't know, Wendy, Bev?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Beverly Walburn is going to begin. She's one of our National Sit Rocky River.
Okay. Good afternoon. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you about the nature-based preschool project. I'm currently a naturalist at Rocky River Nature Center, but I've served as a preschool teacher, so I have a passion for not only environmental education, but early childhood education as well. So this, to me, has been a way to bring both of those passions together. And with such a great organization behind it, where we can also reach those young people and young families that we're trying to bring into the park. So what is a nature-based preschool? It's a preschool that is licensed, and here in Ohio, we're licensed through the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. And the curriculum will emphasize nature. The children will be provided with kindergarten readiness skills. All the children going through a nature-based preschool are ready for kindergarten, and sometimes even have better skill sets than their counterparts in traditional preschools. The nature-based preschool will have a classroom that reflects the outdoors, so a lot of natural light, a lot of natural items within the classrooms. And most nature-based preschools are associated with a nature center because a nature center can provide unique resources for the preschool. It's become something that's being embraced by the nation. It's a proven model, and this is a a news report by NBC National News that was done about a nature-based preschool in California.
Finally tonight, it's no secret that young children love to be outdoors. And with that in mind, more and more schools in this country are embracing learning outside the traditional classroom. They're called nature schools or forest schools. And as we hear from Kristen Dahlgren, they give new meaning to the basics.
At Wildflowers Nature Preschool in Northern California, this is math class.
One, two, three, four.
And the ABCs.
Having.
It's not a field trip.
Lots of words.
This is every day, start to finish, spent outside, from the forest to the garden to the barnyard.
How many babies do you think she has?
A lot.
Professor Beth Buswell, it's all about taking learning beyond a building.
You know, you look at the average school, the idea is that you work inside and you go out for a break. We need the reverse.
They get to run around, explore, and I think really learn some foundational life concepts.
Children connecting to the environment instead of electronics.
When he and I go hiking, he'll stop for like 4 minutes or 5 minutes and just listen and point at birds.
And when we cover the dirt, so-called nature schools are spreading across the country.
Foundational life skills, wow. The smiles on the children's faces. That's what I envision here at Cleveland Metro Parks. But how is a nature preschool different? And really the only difference is that we're utilizing our natural world for learning, a learning environment for the kids. It combines early childhood education as well as environmental education and includes best practices for both. It will help the child develop, and there's been lots of research and studies that show that by the children learning outdoors, touching things, picking things up, experimenting, and experiencing things, that they're getting so much more than their traditional preschool students. They also will get conservation ethics also. So you've got that environmental piece that the children are able to come away with. And the benefits of a nature-based preschool, there is research to show that they are scoring higher. And it's on things like concentration and self-discipline. You think about what children need to be able to identify. It's cold outside. What can I do to get warm? It's raining outside. What can I do? And these are life skills that we're seeing kids in middle school and high school can't figure out how to take care of themselves. And these are 3, 4, 5-year-olds that are able to do that. Healthier kids, they are moving. The amount of childhood obesity, and you know, here we're giving the children at least an hour to an hour and a half outside every day, all season, all year long. You know, there's no such thing as bad weather. It's just not having, you know, having bad clothes to be able to be outdoors. So, you know, they're also sick less because they're not stuck inside of a classroom. You know, classrooms tend to just hold germs in them. So they're outdoors and a lot healthier. They're imaginative and creative play. When they're outside and they've got all of these what we call loose parts, you know, rocks and sticks and leaves, and they're building and creating, and they're watching the stream go by and damming it up and forming a pond, their hands are in it, they're experiencing it. They're not reading about it in a book necessarily, but they're experiencing it, and that generates to, you know, higher test scores and, you know, and just doing better than their counterparts from traditional preschools. I feel it also meets Cleveland Metro Park's mission in providing, you know, education and recreation for students, as well as plan indicators by helping out with providing programming for that ages 3 to 5. Nature-based preschools are growing. Based on this graph, the first nature-based preschool was formed in 1966 in Connecticut. And by 2010, only 24 were in existence in the United States. But in 2012, Dr. Patty Bailey, who actually got her start here in Cleveland at the Nature Center Shaker Lakes, she did research and she published her research on the benefits of nature-based preschools. And by 2015, the number had increased to 150. Five of those, that's a 600% increase, but five of those are here in Ohio. Cincinnati Nature Center has one. Dublin, their recreation department. In Dayton is the Audubon, the Allwood Audubon Center. And Seneca County Parks is Linda Rose, and she is their only naturalist on staff. And what's unique about Seneca County is they're a very similar park district as we are. Legal had looked into Seneca County parks as that model. And what Linda does is she does nature-based preschool for 3 days a week, and the other 2 days she leads field trips and does public programming, and she operates out of their only nature center in the park. But her preschool numbers, she is full, and she has a wait list that goes about 3 years out. So she will allow parents, and when their children are born, to get onto the wait list. And then Laurel School out in Geauga County.
What is the size of the Seneca? How many students do they have in there?
I believe she has 15 students.
15 students.
Yeah, a morning class and an afternoon class.
So 15 in age or 15 total?
15 total, ages 3 to 5. She brings all of the children, all ages together, from ages 3 to 5.
So a question would be where, when, how many?
I have a slide for that.
You know, I should have known.
Currently, we are providing preschool programming above and beyond our monthly programs all throughout Cleveland Metro Parks. So we're doing a really good job of reaching our preschool audience. We have just started within the past few years these more curriculum-based preschool type programs. They meet once a week for 6 week sessions, and these 6 week sessions are run every season. So we have fall, winter, and spring, and then we also offer summer camp opportunities. Small Wonders and Pollywog Preschool are drop-off programs, so parents drop their kids off, they're with us for 2 hours. We spend a lot of time outside, but it's once a week. And what the nature-based preschool would do is provide that 3 day a week program, so it would be the only preschool program that the parents would have to do. We get a lot of children that go to regular preschool come to us 1 day a week because their parents feel that the nature-based programming is important.
And how big are those? Yeah, sorry.
Pardon?
How big are those programs that we run already?
In Small Wonders, I will take 12 children per class this past fall.
Instructors or teachers?
Just me. And a volunteer.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's just the two of us. And in the fall I had a total of 24 that I could take, and I had 22. So the program's filling. Natalie Schroeder's doing Pollywog Preschool out at North Chagrin Nature Center. She just started this fall with her program, and she's getting great feedback from the parents. And Carly Martin out at Lookabout Lodge is doing Lookabout Littles, and hers is a program where the parents stay, but it's still a 2 hour. These are fee-based programs because we are giving the children extended opportunities and extended curriculum for them.
And how many students are in Pollywog?
I believe, let's see. Yeah, she will take up to 12 students.
Both.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think the Lookabout Littles, Carly, same thing, 12. Okay. And which is good, because when you start getting into preschool programs, licensing requires that one teacher for every 12 students for ages 3, and 14 students for every adult or teacher in the classroom for ages 4 and 5. So we're just modeling what you can expect in a preschool.
What constitutes a teacher? What's the definition of that?
Could it be a licensed preschool?
Yeah.
Or at the nature center?
Well, in what we're anticipating. Could you use college students that are majoring in education?
We could not as lead teachers. Licensing requires that the teachers have a degree. A four-year degree is usually what is required for a lead teacher. Assistant teachers could have an associate's degree in early childhood, but what is required for anybody working with young children is at least a child development certificate, which is a certification program that they can go through.
Okay, let me ask you this. My wife, back in the early 60s, had a program like this, and she ran it herself, and she was a college student.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked very, very nicely. And you know, if you have a biology major in mm-hmm. college, it would work effectively. I mean, the mm-hmm. problem with this is scaling it. I mean, we're a metro park with a budget of $140 million, and you know, classes of 12 are really nice, but mm-hmm. they don't scale. Mm-hmm. Can you have it non-licensed and then bring in college students? Why do you have to license it?
The state requires it. If you're going to have children more than 4 hours in a week, then you have to have it licensed. It's required.
So are these programs, these three programs are all licensed as well?
They are not, because we only have the children for 2 hours once a week.
Okay.
So the transition.
I think that would be a nice thing to go to the governor with. That's a ridiculous requirement. I mean, to deprive.
Well, I'm sure the governor could just wave his hand.
No, but I mean, I think that's the kind of thing that a college student could very well handle polywogs and fish and observing birds. I mean, that is not a complicated.
It's the kids that we're worried about, not the polywogs. It's the kids.
No, we have to be mindful of it.
I mean, I think there's a lot of things that are going into this right now. So, I mean, again, this is kind of the concept, the overview.
Yeah.
The zoo has been doing some of these as well. I mean, this is really an information item that we're bringing to the board, kind of thinking about how to position it. And there is a slide to kind of move forward towards that. So I think let's pivot to that and kind of see, because this is kind of a temperature taker right now of how this is. And I think, again, you know, having a child and others having children. I mean, I would want, if I were putting my child in there, to have a license. I mean, all those things I would be asking for versus having. I mean, I've seen college camps and things. I'm not so sure that is where we would want to go with our program. So I think there could be a balance of these smaller ones that maybe these college students feed up into. But if we're going to do this program, we do need that licensure. So I think there's a balance, but I think we're listening to that as well, of how to position this and where to grow it to.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. But I mean, if you have a program that has 12 people in it in a metropolitan area, 2 million people, you know, to me, the number we should have, I think it's a great program. And I think one of the main arguments is you gain your sense of the environment mm-hmm. as a child. I mean, you that happens at a very young age, and you've got to sink it in quick. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think the shameful part is having only being able to do 12 or 24 people. I mean, I think we should do it, but I think we should think of a way that we can scale.
But we're starting, so.
Yeah, and if we had the capacity of having two classrooms, we can serve 7 classes of children, because they're not coming 5 days a week. Your 4s and 5s are going to come 3 days a week. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the morning will be one class. Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the afternoon will be another class. Tuesday, Thursday for the 3s in the morning. Tuesday, Thursday for the 3s in the afternoon. Maybe throw in a 4 and more program for those kids that have late fall birthdays that parents are holding them back from kindergarten. So there's ways that you can utilize the space to have more than the 12 or the 24,
you're
so 7 classes.
Utilizing existing space.
Yeah.
Converting existing.
Well, we currently don't have any existing, we haven't been able to find any current existing space.
So there's a capital issue to it.
Right, and you know, if you're looking at the staff, really, you know, you have licensing requires an administrator to make sure that all the licensing regulations are met. So the staff would include a manager/administrator for the building, lead teachers, 2 lead teachers, and 2 assistant teachers. But those college students are really important to this project, because you bring in those college students into the classroom as part of their pre-service training, and not only are you giving them that opportunity to work within this nature-based preschool, but when they go out and get that job, they're taking those skills to their preschool that they're going to be working at, to their kindergarten class, and you know, be able to share this model to wherever they're taking their job. So their presence there is really important.
I understand all that, but try to think of this will be successful. And so mm-hmm. your next question is going to be, how do you scale it? And I'd love it if you could, you know, get over to the most creative part of what you're thinking about and come up with an idea that you could scale it. I mean, maybe 500 people.
Then let's add additional nature-based preschool facilities. I would love to partner with CMSD and find a preschool building. You know, they're doing preschool at many of our Cleveland Municipal School District buildings. Find one with some natural space. Put one in one of the CMSD buildings. Put one at West Creek. You know, operate something out of West Creek for our southern folks. You know, what about South Chagrin? You know, a lot of the ODJFS is not going to license a preschool if they're in an area that's not going to support it. So finding the right location is really imperative to this too. If there's an area that is that has many open seats, as they're called, in the preschools, you know, licensing will come in and say, but you're not going to make it here. You know, you can't put your preschool here because we already have all of these openings that we can't fill.
You know, so, I would just add too that just we want to succeed, so we're going to do this, well, like we do with everything with Clifton Venture Parks. We're going to do a pilot program. You know, if we decide to do that, we're going to do a pilot program, do it right, learn what we learn, and then talk about scale, but we want to do it right first. And there are a lot of ducks to get in a row, so to speak. So
right.
Bev's got a thought about maybe a next step, so I'll let you
Parents
you
want.
You have an accepted audience.
Parents want only the best for their children. They want to know that their children are getting the best education to prepare them for entering elementary school. And they want to know that those instructors, that those teachers are top-notch, that they are going to provide those, you know, their children. You know, they're entrusting their children, their youngest children, to us. And that's what's so cool about the nature-based preschool is we're not just servicing the children, but we're servicing the families. Mm-hmm. We bring the families in. There's a lot of family interaction and things that happen within the preschool that it's not just about the children. You have, you know, family nights, and you're coordinating with the nature center. These folks are coming into the park. And you know, you've brought all of these this new demographic into the park because now their children are here. I had the opportunity to work with a group of students at Baldwin Wallace in the applied research class, and they just finished up. They developed and executed a survey on the feasibility of a nature-based preschool in Cleveland Metro Parks, and they just reported their findings to me on Tuesday. And I'm not surprised that 68% of the people in Cuyahoga County, and this went out to people with preschool children, so 68% said absolutely, I would send my child to a nature-based preschool if Cleveland Metro Parks were the ones to do this, because they have so much confidence in Cleveland Metro Parks being a leader, and when they do things, they do it right. And 50 out of 158 respondents said if Cleveland Metro Parks opened a nature-based preschool tomorrow, I would enroll my child. So there's already this acceptance that Cleveland Metro Parks will do this right and will, you know, could provide. They're the organization that people believe can do this and to do it in the best way. So we're talking about where to do it. And so this is the site proposal that we have. We wanted to make it close to a nature center in an area that you know, where there's a lot of preschools, but they're all full. There's not many seats left in many of the area preschools. So we're looking at the corner of Shepherd Lane and Valley Parkway and Rocky River Reservation. It's right across the street from Rocky River Nature Center. We simulated a photo to help you kind of get a feel for that space. You know, it's not going to be intrusive because there's already green space there. We get a modular building to put in so that we can get this, you know, prototype going to determine if this is going to be successful and what we need to make this run. Utilize all of that forested area on the backside of Mount Pleasant, and you've got a great site for a possible possible location for the nature-based preschool. So really, I mean, again, I think that people are saying that they believe that Cleveland Metro Parks is the right organization to lead this, and you know, it's been an exciting journey for me as well with you know, connecting with other nature-based preschool folks. There's national workshops that have been going on. I've been able to go for the past 2 years. These pictures are from Fiddlehead Forest School in Seattle, and which is where the next nature-based preschool conference is going to be held in 2017. Any other questions?
Do you have a sense of cost? Have you looked at that yet?
Yeah, the operational pro forma works very well. Now, the renting the building and capital outlay, you know, we have to figure out those funds. That's where Natalie comes in. She's on top of that. But one of the things I did want to say, this is not an uncompetitive space. She's on it. This is not an uncompetitive space. I just went to Rocky River High School, and there are 80 different preschool options for my son. All of them with certified teachers, all of them make him the smartest, all competing, you know, for these kids. So I think, you know, initially doing it and doing it right in a good location where we think there could be some success, knowing the results of the survey, proving that we can do it right, having all these parents become advocates, and this modular building concept really resonated because you can do that anywhere. So we could put that anywhere. There could be a future building that we acquire that may work and be ready for us after we prove concept out there at Rocky River High School. So, you know, me personally, you know, I know you were mentioning the certified, you know, there's, I know a lot of parents on my, if they're not certified, they're not sending their kids there. So I think this modular concept, making sure you flux morning, afternoon, Tuesday, Thursday, Monday versus Wednesday, you can get a couple hundred kids going through that little modular building, all becoming advocates and then expanding it and then getting into Garfield and OEC and getting into those neighborhoods.
So you think the math works well on this? The math,
yeah.
Because I think we have to be thinking, we can't be thinking about 12 or 24.
Right.
Because that doesn't make any sense. But if you could scale it, I think it's extremely valuable, but let's remember that we're not a small place.
Right.
We're not like the typical preschool, and we have a wonderful message to tell. I think that you shouldn't be so worried about proving that we can do it. We know we can do it. What you should be proving is that because you know we can do it, now how can we make it so it's a meaningful big program and how to make the math work. I mean, I think it'd be very valuable to go through some planning here. And I think, you know, Natalie can help because this could be a gifting opportunity, a perfect gifting opportunity. But the point is we have to have the math of what is substantial. I mean, don't you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be very frank. I mean, this is not an action item. That was a great halftime speech. So I think, you know, tempering this, I mean, it was one of the things where I know Wendy and her team have been working at it, and I will tell you, the way Metro Parks goes about it, the way we do it, it will be first class, it will be world class, and it will be scalable and replicable. We also want to make sure that we're the model for others. We have so many park districts and others that come to us how we did it. We also need to have a test case. We can't just say, oh, we're going to be the best, and I don't want to fail. I mean, when you're taking in children, you have grandchildren and children. I mean, we want to make sure we've done it right. So I think that 1 year, and I mean, we are literally in, you know, phase 2-3. We wanted to test the concept with the board to see if there was an appetite for it. We're matching the science, the research, to show that it is possible, and then trying to figure out what our next steps are as we're going into our budget for next year.
But Brian, just for when this comes up again, what is scale? In other words, how big would this program be to make it?
You're very persistent.
To make it so it's, you call it.
I understand where you're going completely, but I think we also want to be very mindful that we don't overbuild, we don't oversaturate. I mean, to hear what Joe said, there's all these different choices. Ours has to be unique and differentiated. I think we can do all those things, but until we have something that we can really talk to and sell, I'm not so sure that I can give you a number of scale, and I know how you'd like to have that, but I don't think we're prepared to do it yet, to be quite honest. I mean, we have not got that far, but I know CMSD, and there's some conversations with the LC2 group, the first 2,000 days, this rolls into that. So I think give us a little bit of time to let it, as the coffee, percolate a little bit, and then we can come back with a little bit more. But we didn't want to get too far down and not have the board's involvement
right.
and engagement.
It's kind of like determining a unit cost and function. And once you do that, then you can replicate.
Yes. And what Beverly brings to the table and what Wendy and the whole group is just, it's really phenomenal, but again, doing it the right way.
It's an excellent presentation. You guys
thank
put a lot of
yeah.
work into that, and it's really
cool.
exciting. So thank
seems
you.
Like it's modeled to do it.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Well, again, what Valerie's doing and the programming and what the zoo is doing, I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways to pivot to, and I think there's a way to fill the gap from, you know, phones to millennials to others, and so there's a way to do it. We just want to make sure that we've really done it the right way. So. Again, I think excellent information, and probably one of the best we've had. So there is no further old business at this point. Next, I will give this. We did a very nice proclamation from the Ohio Senate recognizing Cleveland Metro Parks recipient of the Award of Excellence in Park and Recreation Management. It's from Keith Favor, Senator Tom Patton, and one of our other local representatives, Representative Skin Down. So
wonderful. Thank you. Do we have any public comment? Marty,
Good afternoon. Before I go in, I just have to say that this is the kind of thing I would like to envision, and I agree with Commissioner Moore. I mean, if you can get the kids to experience the outdoors, relate to the outdoors, and they don't care about the outdoors, and they're never going to get that from the video or an app. So, lots of awards to fill display cases. Please don't forget that the measure of the park's success is how it preserves the legacy handed down and how it allows the natural world to enrich the lives of our residents. How much time and money is spent preparing and applying for all those statuettes? How much more is spent sending employees to attend awards banquets? You got a write-up out of it, but Metro Parks have been winning awards for many decades. In a world filled with selfies and self-congratulatory tweets, you can be exceptional by holding to a higher standard, letting your accomplishments speak for themselves. An online story yesterday referred to the $100 million operating budget. While that number is correct, it is misleading, ignoring the capital expenses totaling $56 million, up from $47 million in March. An $8 million, 14% increase in construction contracts in just 6 months. Today there's a chart to reduce the scope of the admin additions. Originally just under $50,000, now it requires board approval to do less. Slow down, take your time, plan and proceed more carefully and avoid situations like the repair of HVAC at Merlin's Wharf. Sipus Air was also known for instant projects and later for other gratification. Promising at first, the not to exceed commitment seems more a wish than reality. Last meeting we heard again that food sales are cushioning golf's poor performance. Yet you plow ahead with Seneca's extra 9 holes. Why are you building more golf facilities than the public wants or needs? You don't have to expand a golf course just to convert it to frisbee or some other use. Financing and staffing food concessions to make up for these deficits is pure nonsense. I spoke before about the risk of park visitors traveling below the crumbling Brook Park Bridge. And now there's Berea's West Center Street Bridge. It's surprising that neither Metro Parks nor its grade inspectors ever looked up as they went under it. Perhaps they could have brought the damage to the city's attention sooner. Guess a miss is as good as a mile for all the park visitors that have passed beneath it. To sum up, spend money cautiously, lest you run out. Take care of your patrons first, safety. Just address their interests without bribing them to support your favorites, which, like food, may be well filled by the private sector. Above all, commit to the founding legislation, not an altered mission statement. If you do right, you will do well, and you will be recognized for it. Thank you.
Brian, quick question. On that, there is that bridge as you go along the Rocky River Drive there. Is that, have there been any problems with, I mean, have there been any near misses of concrete falling off the thing?
I can't necessarily, there are a number of them that cross the Rocky River.
Right, right.
Also include, I-480, which are not under the jurisdiction of Cleveland Metro Parks.
Yeah,
however,
right.
We work with each one of the municipalities, we work with Ohio Department of Transportation, and there are a number of scenarios where different things have happened to try to preserve. Funding isn't always available, and so we're always in the process of working with them on Hilliard and the others. They have some projects coming forward. We want to make sure that the trails stay open and active. And so, that's that public-public partnership that you're trying to work through in all of those scenarios. So I can't necessarily speak to that. The Rangers maybe have a little bit better handle, or Sean may have, incidents or occurrences. But certainly things have definitely come down, along the way. From at least from what I'm aware of.
Well, what might be interesting is to clear the debris that has come down and keep an eye on it every 6 months and see what the propensity is.
I would say we do. I mean, our teams do, as they're going through. And so, again, talking with different municipalities, sometimes you give them the information, and what they so choose to do with it is up to them. So, again, I think the work that we do with all of the municipalities along the corridor and across the park district, when we're working in Sullivan and Fairview Park and Rocky River and Strongsville that continues to, you know, to be a balancing act of the interest of the park and the preservation of the land and access to some of these capital projects. And the bridges that will go under construction in the next coming years are going to be somewhat of an inconvenience to the park goers. And the two would include some areas even down by the Centennial Trail where they need to make some connections. So our teams are informed and they try to make the best possible decisions to create active nodes for our patrons to get through. But it's always a work in progress, I can tell you that, especially as things change or construction technologies and methodologies change and or birds or falcons that that need to be taken care of as well. So stay tuned. I mean, we're definitely on it.
Any other comments? All right, we do have an executive session. Rose, if you could.
Yes, is there a motion to go into executive session for the purposes of discussing personnel, specifically compensation?
So
moved. Roll call, please.
Deputy Mayor?
Yes.
Dan Moore?
Yes.
Bruce Stricker?
Yes. And second.
Thank you. As we have in the past, we're going to go into executive session. We're going to stay. We will not take any action, but we'll come back to adjourn the meeting. So thank you. All right.